Welcome to another episode of Professional Awesome Hypercritical Radio. Today's show is presented by Fuel Lab. Fuel Lab has been a proud supporter of Professional Awesome for quite some time now. We have their fuel surge tank in our S2000 as well. It's been using their brushless fuel pumps in our Evo for a while. Great products. Be sure to go there. Check out their website. Even check out their new quick change fuel surge tank. And courtesy of us, you get a special discount code. Just type in Tyrone at checkout, and you get a little bit off. So do me a favor, do us a favor, and go check it out. And while you're at it, might as well give us the goddamn reviews I keep asking for. But anyways, to the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Professional Awesome Racing's Hypercritical Radio. I'm Hayden Lowe, and I'm joined by some other hosts today.
Mike Lewin.
Devin Giles.
Daniel O'Donnell.
And we're joined by a guest. Please introduce yourself.
Micah McMahon.
Oh, shit. What up?
You can go on.
Yeah, what do you do?
Oh.
Or what have you done?
Who are you, idiot?
Straight into the fire.
I'm Micah McMahon, professional engineer. Play with race cars for a living, design race engines more so. But yeah.
Any nice people with you who you've worked with? Any
company? Oh, in the past? Let's see.
You're going to have to just fill this next 60 minutes straight without us asking any questions. Yeah, so.
I thought we talked about this. Get with it.
All right. So previously, grassroots stuff, did Time Attack stateside with Turning Concepts before hopping off professionally to design race engines at Roush Yates. Hired for the Ford GT project and some GT350 RC project. And, of course, getting swept up into the NASCAR side of things. Left there, did some consulting for a bit. Got picked up by Red Bull Powertrains to go help start their program. And then I'm back here stateside working for myself again.
So you're pretty much a big deal is what you're saying.
That sounds like it.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like what do you do stateside?
Small fish in a very big pond. It's actually, it's kind of weird. That level of motorsports, it gets me in a really small pond. People get to know everybody, and it's kind of odd.
Well, just what's it like being better than everyone?
Yeah. What's it like up there? Like, so
you realize you're not. The same in the graph where the more you know, the realize you don't know.
Dunning-Kruger?
Yeah. Dunning-Kruger. Thank you. That's the one. Yeah, it's one of those. You know, you're far enough down the rabbit hole that everybody has their expertise. So,
sure. I was interested in, because we kind of raced against you a little bit, because when you were with Turning Concepts, that was when we were hitting our stride at Professional Awesome in the street and limited class Time Attack stuff. And so you were in the background helping out Turning Concepts. And we always looked up to Turning Concepts because they did such a phenomenal job. And to see you go from, you know, kind of what we aspired to then end up in what we would consider like, you know, the highest echelon of motorsports that at least I have any interest in. It's pretty cool. But I did like, you know, joking around about what's it like being the best. I also want to know, were you surrounded by idiots as well? And you're like, how the hell are these guys working here?
At Red Bull, no.
And name specifics, please.
Red Bull, no. It was really nice. I mean, I got there early enough. I got to hire most of my team, guys coming in. It's really interesting in that environment, the engineering aspects handled completely differently than, say, like Roush Yates and how NASCAR does it. It's also a vastly different rule book. It's not the same base engine that they've been slightly tweaking for the last, you know, 60 years. So it's way more of an actual engineering practice, and you need an army to do it because things change so rapidly. And in doing so, you can't really have dummies. A dummy's dead weight. So everybody's sharp. Everybody has their spot. But at the same time, I'm sure you guys have all worked with smart people where common sense doesn't exist. Like, they're just lacking. Like, they're so smart. They're like a basic thing. They're like, oh, I never thought of it that way. There are times in there I actually felt like I was the dummy, being quite honest, because, you know, you get out of your element. Like, I'm not an expert in this section of vibrations or this bit of combustion, you know, design. I'm going, okay, well, I'm just going to shut up and listen. So,
did anyone have like an engine specific, like, engineering background, or would you be bringing in people that, yeah, like, I wouldn't have guessed, like, were you bringing in earthquake specialists that just like, oh, that carries over?
No, not everybody had to be an engine specialist. So, for instance, we had a materials group where those guys are just way down the rabbit hole on tribology and knowledge of all kinds of materials and heat treats and ways to finish something and this, that, and the other. And, you know, I know enough that I could go over with ideas and pitch stuff back and forth. Like, you know, that's a good idea, but blah, blah, blah. If we did this, it's a similar material, but handles elevated temperature, its yield stress is so much higher. You start getting down that rabbit hole. And so I'd go talk with those guys. Then I had the combustion guys who my group heavily worked, the combustion sim guys. Performance Sim is the name of the group that they had. And I was Performance Design. So we obviously worked a lot together. And on the other side of me were the simulation guys who are doing all of your fluid flow and thermal and structural analysis of the engine. So they're all over there doing, all right, well, half of my group was designing basically an engine from the inside out, all the critical surfaces, your ports, your combustion chambers, valve sizes, placements, angles, injector placement, pre-chamber geometries, all that sort of stuff. So you all started from the inside and you go, all right, now we have to wrap it in metal, make it an actual cylinder head and an actual block. And how do you do that? And so once you get to that point, that goes to your fluids, structures, simulation group. But everything you did up to that point was with the performance simulation where they're doing just combustion analysis. So essentially crazy, crazy high-level CFD work.
Is the combustion analysis, what software do they use?
Converge. We're using pretty heavily.
Yeah. And it's a single cylinder?
So yeah, I was a single cylinder group. Also did analysis for, of course, essentially a tank. So an inline 3 and V6 as a full 3D analysis, that sort of stuff. But yeah, the 1D, 2D, 3D analysis would get done. So for those that don't know, 1D is where you think of it essentially kind of laid out as one thing that as a timeline of what's going on. So this is where the air is coming in and the characteristics that goes on with it. In other terms, like guys think of Helmholtz. All right, so what's the length for the resonance and how's this behaving? Goes to the chamber, comes out on the exhaust side, you're doing the same thing. And what pressures do you have and temperatures and how it'll behave before you go to do a bigger, heavier run?
Yeah.
So 1D's are quick.
I've done some GT Power and some other softwares like that, but never Converge. What'd you say it was?
Yes.
Yeah.
Converge? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
GT Power gets used a lot too. So.
Okay. Yeah.
Converge is the heavy CFD seat.
Right. I assume the GT Power is in conjunction then. Because they do a little bit different things from what I understand. You get a little bit different result. Like, how can I say this? One's more based on flame propagation, the other one's more based on fluid flow.
Well, so the thing is, you have to have all of the proper, I'll say, boundary conditions in your CFD
like
for your CFD
like
to
anything.
Work anything. So so there's a lot of, you know, you're testing, you see, all right, no, that matches up, we're actually jiving. So, for instance, I mean, the guys, super sharp group of guys, our first model for the D6, if I recall, they were within like 2 kilowatts of what they actually got off the dyno. It was pretty wild. Like, first stab at it, this is what we know from places we've been before, run through all this stuff, this kind of ballpark where we'll be, blah, 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 bang. Within about 2 kilowatts.
And that's, you're saying with the single cylinder simulation?
That was a V6?
That was the V6.
Yeah. You're saying they simulated the entire engine in?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. So you go through and kind of pair everything up and how it'll go and when you're, you know, designing your own turbo and designing your own everything.
Yeah. Is that, and I assume like across the rev range, those types of things. So you're,
well, the rev range is really narrow for an F1 engine, if you think about
it. Yeah, comparatively. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. You go, all right, 9,000 is about as low as we're going to go. And essentially, the name of the game is, 9,000 is as low as you go, right? And then essentially, the name of the game is they cut off your fuel flow. Well, cap it at 10.5. And anything past that's how lean can you go and still make power? And that's really, everybody can go to 15,000, but it's not worth it if you're not making power and you're just burning up the friction.
A question I have in that, I want to go back to the start, but the question I have in that is, can burning constituent oil to attempt, right, to keep the mixture from leaning out too far, is that what, there was some teams that were doing some things like that, right?
Yeah, they clamped down on the oil burning for
you could only
energy in the chamber.
Exactly. So when the simulations were happening and when they realized the fluid, you know, the fuel flow was the limitation, and they're like, we want to keep going a little bit further and push it just a little bit further. Was that something you were a part of where you're like, the team's like, we can burn some oil here and we can keep going a little bit longer if we burn some oil.
So that those rules got clamped down way, way before I was there. That was like 2015 or so.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. Because that would be super interesting conversation where you're like, we're going to let a little oil in the chamber here and we're going to use it for constituent, you know.
There may be situations where it'd be advantageous to have some extra oil, yes. It is, however, very tightly controlled. And when you're doing your own custom blends of oil, which you do at this level, there are additives you can put in there that are also beneficial too. However, the amount of oil you're allowed to use is literally a rule that they have. So Yeah. So
the same concept of using Lesters and things like that for base five group stocks, and then using ash base and stuff like that for your ad pack to change the constituents of combustion and ensure that you don't have abnormal combustion, but you can have abnormal combustion without detonation then.
Yeah.
And so that's something that, yeah, because it was, for perspective wise, not the same thing, but actually kind of similar in, so like Caterpillar, when I worked at Caterpillar, I worked on the natural gas side of the genset. So these are 100 and, you know, these are small gensets, so 20 liters, small, up to 256 liters. And so working RPM is generally 1500 RPM, and that's more due to the output for the generator, which is 50 or 60 hertz. And so they run it through a gearbox to get 60 hertz. They run it through no gearbox to get 50 hertz. So that, you know, works everywhere else in the world. Mm-hmm. And then the 60 hertz works here. But the constituent or the power output and the efficiency, the thermal efficiency of those engines is extremely high comparatively to anything else that's like normal. And so the newest version when I was there was the H engine. And at the time, it was peaking on 46-something% efficiency.
Yeah.
46.5. And so like F1 now is over 50, right? I don't even know what the number is right now. But it's not, it wasn't the same order of magnitude like normal cars, right? Normal cars are 35, 40 now. And then you have those engines were 46 to 48 maybe but we couldn't make them last at those higher numbers. But 46 was
46
possible.
46 to 48 what?
Thermal efficiency, percentage thermal efficiency.
Oh, percent thermal efficiency, gotcha.
Yeah, for input of, you know, fuel, right?
Yeah.
And so, obviously, these are natural gas, so it's not the same, right? The fuel types do have some effects there, but you don't get cooling efficiency and things like that out of natural gas. There's no, because it's not a phase change material comparatively, right? You don't get that phase change to help with cooling. You don't get any of that stuff. But also, the engines are running at, like I said, 1,500 RPM. So you don't get a lot of, you know, obviously the torque is the answer. They're 2 megawatt power units for a 20 cylinder or a 1.5 megawatts for 16 cylinder, 1.6 megawatts. But it's interesting because there is a lot of commonality there because we're fighting the edge of abnormal combustion. We designed, like I was part of the team who was working with oil suppliers from all over the world to come up with potential ad pack designs. For the base stocks, right? And we were on an ester base for a while. We were a group 5 ester base for a while to improve the potential for abnormal combustion, one, fine, but to limit detonation as a potential, but allow for some of that abnormal combustion and that oil combustion into the cylinder to actually improve combustion efficiency and potentially, right, keep it, make it more reliable. So it's similar. It's funny how similar it is. It's not the same thing. Right, there's a lot of differences there in terms of sizing and all that stuff, but it's super interesting that we were working through kind of similar problems that you would work through in F1 for a complete, like something that would not even, most people would go, that's not even close, right?
Yeah, what most people don't realize is it's just a different engine with a different expected output, right? What's it doing? It's got a different role.
For sure.
Like, so with Formula One, the part is, of course, modern days are running extremely lean, really big boost, heavily Miller cycled engines, which is how they get away with the crazy numbers. You know, if I just told you it's running lambda 1.8 and they're running, you know, 5 bar a boost, you're going to be like, holy, how? It's 102 RON. Like, what? How is that possible? So you get in the thermo game of it and, you know, how you're playing with the different cycles. But, for instance, you would have same gear, same RPM, same load, pulling in a different portion of the track, but depending on what it did before that section of the track, one would knock and the other wouldn't.
Right.
Yeah. I'm talking these engines when they have a knock occurrence, you're talking, without getting specifics, pushing on 1,000 bar. Like,
wow.
Seriously, so massive.
True detonation comparatively. So, so what I would love to hear you talk about a little bit here, like in that where we talked a little bit about abnormal combustion and the difference between abnormal combustion and detonation. And what people don't seem to realize is that there's some amount of abnormal combustion, especially in high-strung engines, that is not necessarily detonation. And people contribute abnormal combustion and detonation to the same factors, and they're not even close in a lot of cases. And so it's like, is that something that you could define better from your perspective between
I wouldn't say I would be able to. So the things, like, for instance, for like a gen set, one of the things that's easier is you're essentially at a fixed thermal load and a fixed RPM.
That's what makes it. Yeah, it makes it so easy comparatively because we're sitting at 1,500. So it's always the same. Yeah.
You know,
the cooling is always the same.
there's very little thermal shock, or there's very limited load shock, right?
The only problem, though, you'd have fuel inconsistencies, correct, Mike?
I was going to say
that's the biggest
Dan
thing.
Dan listens to me. It's crazy. The natural gas changes constantly.
Yeah, I'm aware. So,
yeah,
I used to work in the diesel world as well. So
yeah. So the pipe natural gas changes constantly. So what I would have to do, you have quality meters. You test the gas constantly. And when you're that strung out, right, when the engine is that efficient comparatively, just like what you're doing, right, if you had changed the constituents of your fuel at all, you could change the constituents of your oil. Like I said, you put in a different oil and you're burning some of that oil in combustion, intentionally or unintentionally, depending on the year. It's always intentional, but you get the point. When you have that change, all of a sudden, everything's different, right? That's a big problem. And so one of the things that I had to do was go to different sites all around the world, tune engines specifically based on the natural gas type, quality, and constituents. And sometimes they'd be all over the board, like in terms of like people think of it in terms of RON, right? Like when they're talking about octane levels or, and, you know, combustibility and things like that, it can be all over the board because your flame front speeds can be different, but your resistance to knock can be different too. So there's like this, the best I can describe it is like a bubble, right? Where it can work or it's not going to work. And there, you take all those factors and you put them inside that bubble to figure out where you're kind of sitting, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, I wouldn't say it was like super hard because we were just trying to hone in as best we could. And then if the natural gas changed pretty substantially over time, there were meters that would check and check and check. And there was feedback loops, right? Like it's not a somewhat closed loop. It was pretty closed loop, but it's not like super closed loop. It's not great.
Did you guys ever treat it kind of like, you know, if you had a meter for how it was behaving, did you know how it was? I'm assuming you knew how you were supposed to alter the tune. I mean, kind of treat it like a flex fuel sensor in, you know, our aftermarket performance world. Is that kind of how you guys did it? Or
was to it very an extent, yeah. Still? So I would use individual EGTs across the board, right? I can look at the wind. So it's a gas engine, not diesel. So a natural gas engine. So there was spark plugs. So I could look at how each individual coil was firing, how much energy it was outputting. So there was a feedback on the coil, which is nice. Mm-hmm. So they're smart, right?
Yeah, you had a smart coil.
And so I can look, like, people don't realize that is super helpful, right? Because how hard that is hitting tells you a lot about the density or the difficulty in igniting the fuel mixture, right? And so that's understandable for people who tune often. That's understandable for people who tune at more of a higher level. But lots of people don't even like, wait, but what? And so with a consistent, and there was, in these cases, some pre-chamber, some non-pre-chamber, the bigger engines pre-chamber. And so
that's what I was about to
thing.
Ask you. And I was going to say, were you guys using the pre-chambered spark plugs or not?
Right, okay. Exactly. So all the spark plugs were pre-chambered, but then there's even the bigger engines use actual pre-chambers like it's an actual chamber. Like you ignite a mixture, a smaller mixture in another area, and then you flow that in.
Yeah, like World War II airplane engines. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah, exactly. And then these engines use a shrouded spark plug. So from that perspective, it's a spark plug that looks like a dome. If you've never seen one, you can go look that up. But it looks like a dome. And then there's four holes or more. Sometimes there's more holes on the exterior of that plug, so that the spark is actually inside that dome, so it's completely protected from the rest of the cylinder, and then it fires out those four holes, if you will, or eight holes sometimes.
Yeah.
And so it's a different thing.
If there's a chambered spark plug, is there fuel injected directly into the plug?
It just uses the constituent of the fuel in the chamber. You know, it flows into the plug. There's the position
they're never
the
running.
Plug.
They're never running super lean. So you're say, right. For instance, you're at a stoichiometric mixture.
Okay.
You're still pushing stoichiometric fuel into the plug. The nice thing is
relatively
now
close.
Because you've got the small dome where the dome is. You know, it's capped. It pushes in through those holes. Spark plug only has to go this certain distance with its arc, right? So you're kind of making a same spot. And then the holes, it shoots out plumes to further regions more quickly, expanding your flame to far regions.
Because people don't understand flame propagation. That the simplest concept, right, is olden days idea would be, make the spark plug gap as big as you can on a traditional spark plug, because the larger the shock, right, the larger the voltage that you're crossing, you're igniting more fuel, which can increase the speed of the flame front because it's an exponential function, right? It's as it touches more molecules, it burns more molecules. Fine. That makes a lot of sense. And so that's why when people run smaller gaps, the unneeded, they run smaller gaps, you limit the flame front propagation rate. Now, there's back and forth on if that's good or not, because you can cause some abnormal combustion, you can cause some detonation. But anyway, the point being is, like Dan was asking, with is there fuel? You're right. We're more close to stoichiometric, especially because we are looking for max BMEP, right? We are looking for only cylinder pressure all the time and nothing else. And so our fueling is relatively quote unquote rich comparatively to someone who's trying to sip fuel, right?
Well,
we're still looking for efficiency, but we're not necessarily looking for a limit on fuel over time. So you can still get that flow into that spark plug. It still works pretty well. But I'm just saying the similarities there are pretty interesting. And so the closed loop you were asking about, individual EGTs, smart coils to be able to understand, you know, how much energy that's taking, O2 sensors, NOx sensors, NOx being a big one for us to be able to understand, you know, the condition of the engine and the condition of the fueling. And then there, like I said, there is some closed loop capability, like moving up and down a little bit in terms of fuel quality. But yeah, on some of the engines where they were far away, a lot of the engines I worked on were prototypes. So I would put logging information, like logging on the engines, and I would look at that logged information all the time. So I'd literally log in, like remote tune, if you will, to some extent. And I would look at that data and go, hey, this looks like the fuel quality has changed over time. Our thermal efficiency, I would, you know, back calculate thermal efficiency for output versus fuel flow. You get the point. And then I'd say, yeah, we're marging on a couple percent, like maybe a percent or two here has changed. We need to redo this as a base. And just like anything else, right? That makes a lot of sense. And so it is interesting from that perspective. You know, you're working on something that's like the best, right? F1 has the most thermal efficiency out of anybody right now, as far as I know, right? I think so. I mean, I hope so.
I mean, there might be some crazy diesel projects that are doing somewhere.
Sure, fine. But yeah, I think that, you know, F1, you know, you're working on those projects, but it's not dissimilar.
Yep.
I think the single RPM helps a lot in our case.
Well, it's funny. So, you know, people keep bringing up battery vehicles and all the sort of stuff, like looking like what's our next step in transportation. Like, I would love to see inline PHEVs, to get boring and not talk about race engines here, but the same sort of thing. So you take a gasoline engine and you make it to run extremely efficiently as literally just a generator. That's all it does. And aside from that, right, you have a battery you can plug
and
in.
And we're back to the Chevy Volt.
No. That was done all improperly.
Yeah, I know.
I'm sure there's some Chevy GM engineers who are like punching your computer now. But
that's okay.
And the thing is, you just plug it. But the thing is, in my mind, you'd have a big enough battery that's, you know, enough for a day or two of daily driving, right? 120 miles of range or something. Anything beyond that, you just kick on the gen set and keep rolling. No big deal. Oh, darn, the Tesla superchargers have 38 people stacked up at them. I'll pass that and go to the gas station, or just charge it when I get home, because my 110 charger at home is no different than running my refrigerator. You know, the charger's hanging battery. But, yeah.
No, I mean, there's a lot of, I do think that a series base hybrid, right? That's what that would be.
Inline. That's what that's called. Inline or series, yeah. And then PHEV being plug-in hybrid electric vehicle. Yeah.
Yeah, and then but I'm saying like series versus parallel. Parallel is when the engine actually provides power along with the electric motor.
Yeah, it's a Prius. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, so that would be a series-based hybrid. Like, I do like series-based hybrids a lot. Priuses do a great job. They've done a really good job. But I do like the concept. I've always liked the concept of a series-based hybrid, especially if you have, from my perspective at least, an incredibly small diesel engine that is capable of putting out an aggressive amount of BMEP. So
yep.
That's just, you know.
And then honestly, with direct injected gas and what we have going
now.
Yeah,
it's getting pretty close.
You could do a Lambda-1 engine, and Lambda-1 being, it basically runs a stoichiometric at full load. And essentially, you have no emissions to really clean up other than a simple cat, and that's it. And you just let the thing run and get great fuel economy because you design it to run at 1 RPM. It fires up, gets warm. You could even have preheaters, so it just jumps right to RPM because guess what? The coolant and oil are already warm. Like, how does that happen?
And you don't... And you don't need variable valve timing. You don't need to worry about
tension as much. You don't need any of it. Yeah, you throw all the expensive,
all
crazy
things,
crap out the window.
Yep. Right, yeah. You can literally run almost like the simplest of adjustable temperature, auto-adjustable, because you're not changing RPM, which means you don't have belt lash, which means you don't have chain lash, which means you don't have all these other problems that come along with it. It is a better way. Anyway.
Yeah. Back to fun stuff, racing.
Back up. So what I was going to ask is, from your time there, obviously you said that you're a performance design engineer. Is that correct?
Yeah, what's the title? Performance design team leader. There we go.
Okay,
air
team
quotes.
Leader, my fault. I'm sorry. Sorry, team leader. So we talked to an aero specialist previously and stuff like that in terms of development, and obviously you're on the development side. And so what I like to understand is how that development happens. And for me, obviously, there's a lot at the level, and same with him and this level, right? There's a There's a simulation base, right? There's a design, a simulation, a design, a simulation. There is some back and forth there. And I wanted to understand how that worked. So if you're designing, did you have to design a new, a completely new engine on that V6? Were you part of that design?
Well, by way of the V6, also everything we handed from the single cylinder. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, so and let me jump into real quick. So your Red Bull powertrains, or you were at the time, I assume there wasn't any IP coming from Honda?
Yeah, so when I interviewed early in the fall, I think it was September when I interviewed, the plan was still that Honda, that the working group was Honda was going to basically hand over IP and allow Red Bull to pick up where they left off and keep the program running and kind of make it their own. When I showed up in January, due to some delays and all the other stuff that happens, get there and they're like, yes, yeah, so that didn't happen and we got a blank sheet of paper. So, you know, at that time, they're probably maybe 50 of us or so at the time. We were still in the MK7 building. We didn't even have the powertrains building. We were still hiring up. Like, my team had, like, 2 people in it.
What year, roughly?
This was January of 22.
Okay, and you're designing for 2026?
For 26, yeah.
Okay. I'm just, the lead times.
Yeah. Insanity. So my team heavily got focused on it. It became a priority where we're going to have the single and the V6 essentially running along in parallel. But with that being said, the single was put on to be a bit delayed because everything we were focusing on was to get to the V6 so they could have all those critical geometries, cam profiles, all this sort of stuff. We're kind of working early on, it was hand in hand. We're kind of muddled together. Like, I'm in design reviews for V6 stuff. V6 guys are handing over some stuff that they did. So someone on my team doesn't have to do those calculations again. And so it became kind of a mashup early on. And then it kind of started separating at the end where we started working on Ford projects, you know, how many different cylinder heads and all this other ports, chambers, pistons, different study, all kinds of things being swapped around. Of course, camshafts galore, all this stuff kind of going on. That when you end up finding the winner of what you really like, and of course, with the testing that you do. So here, to get to the testing. So we designed something, right? You go through this whole thing, iteration with, you know, all the different simulation groups that we're tied into. So now we'll say you have your engine, right, that you have designed. There's a lot of rigs testing that happens as well outside of actually being on a dyno because the FIA controls dyno, because otherwise people would just run V6s around the clock. That's why the single cylinders are mandated. And the single cylinders are, honestly, it's really terrible. It reminds me of some of the things NASCAR would do. Like, it would make more sense for them to make it, you can have an inline three, because at least an inline three will, the bank will behave a lot more like the V6, right? In terms of, you know, gas exchange, sure, on the intake and the exhaust side. So that makes sense. Meanwhile, you get to a single, you've got one exhaust pulse. How does one exhaust pulse behave compared to three going into a collector that's bouncing back from your turbine, right? Like, right. Well, it's not the same. So
especially turbo cars, yeah, that'd be
so. Then we went way down the rabbit hole. Sharp fellows who worked in the performance simulation group had something similar at a previous employer, and so we went down the rabbit hole of doing this whole crazy, crazy laid out, weird shaped cones, deflectors, all kinds of stuff in the exhaust system to make it behave and match up with essentially going back to your GG power, your analysis of what the V6 exhaust pulses were looking like and the single cylinder exhaust pulses, so that at least your single cylinder data was going to be relatable to the V6.
So you weren't injecting anything. You were just, you just made the geometry of the manifold in a way that the subsequent forces were similar, as if there was air going into the collector similarly, or you actually injected air to simulate other cylinders?
No, it's all just in the base physics of it that we weren't injecting.
Base design.
I mean, I went down the rabbit hole talking about, like, I could make an inline three, but if the other two cylinders don't reflect that of a Formula One, because by the rules, I'm like, I could make an inline three. I have two dummy cylinders. You're just pumping air, but then the air going out the other side, it's cold air, so it's not the same. And yeah.
Sure.
Like, we did all that, well, I'll call it mental masturbation on that sort of stuff. And
I'm wondering, like, you know, obviously, is that legal or not, right? Can you make a... for lack of a better term. Well, can you put little injector flamethrowers, right, into the exhaust at certain distances that would constitutively be burned at the same rate, right, in the same temperature, and be like, choo, choo, choo,
to have the same temperature and pressure profile would be pretty hard to do.
It would be hard to do, right. I'm not,
like,
saying
that would be
that's
its
not,
own
that's not
crazy good. Separate experiment.
But you get close. Yeah, you get closer.
Perhaps.
Right?
Closer. I don't know. But
it might steer you wrong. It could absolutely steer you wrong. But
yes,
it's just interesting.
So without getting too far into that, because that's some pretty critical IP stuff.
Sure.
Yeah, so you'd have the single, right? But before that, before it goes to V6, so the V6 is essentially what has the lockdown testing hours. There's a lot of rig time that gets done. So you know, instead of like, in the NASCAR world, we call it a Spintron. I think in the performance aftermarket, enough people are starting to hear about Spintron stuff.
They're trying to call it, they're calling it Spintrons now. I think people know what those are.
Yeah, yeah. So essentially, a Spintron is something that spins up your entire engine, runs it through. You can do all kinds of valvetrain tests or ring pack friction tests and all kinds of stuff you can do with them. We used them a lot when I was at Roush Yates. They're used for all kinds of stuff. Basically, they're running around the clock. In Formula One, they break it down into more specific bits. Like you'll have a oil piston squirt jet rig that makes sure that your squirters are doing what you want them to and spraying where you want them to. And they're also kind of a QA aspect in that regard. You'll then have one that's literally just for the cylinder head to run valve train. You'll have one that's blanked off just to basically validate gear train. You'll have all kinds of rigs. If you can think of a way that you want to be able to test and run something, there's a rig for it before it goes onto the actual dyno to be run. Then of course it runs on the dyno. You get data off of that. Performance sim guys want to see it for correlation to their models, obviously. We want to see where it goes to go along with what we model in terms of, you know, say your vibrations and torsionals that you have in gear train and valve train and, you know, every aspect you want. So you, I'll say it is a engine engineer's wet dream. We had every toy you could think. Basically, the entire AVL catalog was opened up. We are doing analysis between Kistlers and AVLs back and forth around and seeing whose sensors we like more than the others. Like, it was, yeah. Or you'd have specific ones that are used for a certain test because it's more sensitive than another one. You know, that sort of thing.
Is there I don't know if you can answer, like, because there might be some proprietary things here, but is there a sensor or something that you were using when you were doing those engine analysis? Because obviously, you were measuring, I would absolutely 100% assume you're measuring cylinder pressures directly, right?
Yeah.
Were you using the actual sensor or are you using the spark plug type?
No, I didn't use spark plug type at all. We literally had just two in the chamber.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And in certain heads, we'd have more than two.
Sure.
Depending on what we're measuring.
Space is available. And
Well, that was half of my team's job is there's no space. You figure out how to make it work. Yeah.
where can we poke a hole right now without screwing this whole thing up?
The thermo guys who are like, I really want to put the sensor in the head. Can you put it somewhere?
Yeah.
Well, let me figure that out for you.
Yeah. Where's this going to not F everything up? But yeah, that's very interesting. So was there any other sensors? Were there sensors that were used that you really hadn't seen used elsewhere in your career that you really were like, wow, that's something different compared to?
Yeah. ICPSs or in-cylinder pressure sensors are quite the standard. They tell you a lot. They're fantastic. If you're serious, like I know there's some time attack guys here, if you have a really serious time attack program going, I can steer you to some consultants who do the stuff on the side that can help you develop your stuff. On top of that, it helps you save money in the end. This is going to sound crazy. You have someone like me or someone like Mike who can do FEA, and with in-cylinder pressure data, you can really look at your rods and go to an SN curve, which is essentially fatigue life of a given loading on a given material. And you can forecast when those rods are going to, fantastically just explode into a million pieces. And
from a fatigue limit standpoint, I mean, that's all good points. Yeah.
So yeah, while it might be expensive to get this, set up, have a donor head that you're going to drill out and do some testing on and go, all right, cool. That's where that is. We know at this power level, we're running this. My rods and pistons can handle this for how long? Infinitely long or a season or two or, that sort of thing. Right. And that ends up saving a lot of money.
Yeah. Most of the time we just build it to, just try to find the strongest thing you can find. I mean, most people are just like, I just try to find the strongest rod I can find. I mean, kind of.
Yeah, but even then, like an off-the-shelf rod, you don't really know anything about it other than some guy said, hey, here's the best thing from China.
Not disagreeing with anything you just said.
Hey, don't talk shit about China.
Hey,
they're going to come after us.
I know, Kegley, who does for Evo guys, that name will be familiar. He's DSM drag race guy who makes them oil control products for cylinder heads and Evos. I know he runs in cylinder pressure in his DSM drag car
live, but like all the time.
I believe so. Yeah.
And that's why
probably I guess.
Yeah. And that's what we were looking at too. We wanted to run the spark plug type for a little bit just because it's less intrusive. It's obviously not as good, but it's less intrusive comparatively and it makes it a little easier. They'll make those custom spark plugs with the sensor integrated. If you haven't seen those, go check those out.
Considering spark plugs consumable, that gets really pricey.
No. I'm not disagreeing with any of that, but it's, if you don't want to machine a cylinder head and kill the cylinder head, then fine.
Well, it doesn't necessarily kill it either. I also know ways to do it so you don't end up killing your cylinder head. So there's ways ahead where you're not just blindly drilling holes and going, what's happening? So there are actually tools that you can engineer a solution for.
I don't like that.
We can ultrasound. We can figure out where the actual pockets are. We can figure out where we're going.
Dad's old Black and Decker out. We're putting holes in the head.
Speed holes.
Yeah, just put them on the drill press. So we'll get it done. It's no big deal.
I had heard from, I can't remember if it was, I think it was Kissler. I can't, or it might have been AVL.
We've talked to both of them a lot, so.
Yeah. I was told that they were running live feedback off in-cylinder.
Yeah. Using that to control timing live.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fucking wild.
I mean, why wouldn't you?
Why wouldn't you do that?
Yes, stupid, Dan. Dumb question.
It's the one sensor that's telling the most about your combustion performance.
Certainly. Yeah.
But hands down.
The magnitude of processing power, because you probably know how many combustion cycles are there in a at 13,000 RPM or whatever.
Yeah, for a V6 and to be able to feedback.
He said they fit, the feedback was one cycle. So it was like, come on, that's just ridiculous.
Yeah, I don't even know what the frequency was for those sensors. I got to think about what is the frequency for the sensors you were using? Do you remember?
I don't recall offhand.
100.
It was a ridiculous speed.
Silly. And it's fast enough you're not having aliasing either, obviously. Like, it's silly fast. Right. And likewise, we also have the same for pressure transducers and everything else in Thesel. So you want to know what your intake manifold is doing, you know, where you're measuring pressure as the charger is coming in. And here's the thing, like, so many people are like, oh, it's turbocharged. You know, manifold design doesn't matter. I'm like, it's still an air pump, so yes. They're like, oh, log manifolds, it'll work just as well. I'm like, that's not how any of this works.
Yeah, well, so, isn't that what Mercedes started, like, with a log style?
And they got rid of it.
Right.
For packaging and then got rid of it, yeah.
And you look at the Mercedes now, cars, the last picture I saw of Mercedes, it looked like it had a triple scroll. If I had to guess, it looked like it had a triple scroll turbine.
Interesting.
Looking sweet.
Yeah. Separately from F1 talk, I do like log manifolds for most reasonable cars.
Like, simple and compact to put together.
Yeah, and now that you have people like, who are they, Dan? Who's the Artec? And other people who are making and MA Performance and stuff who made investment cast manifolds, you have much less likely, at least if the processing's good, obviously. Caveat to every single thing we're going to say ever. But as long as it's well made, you have a much less chance of causing cracking and those types of things.
Those aren't a log manifold.
No, it's not true log. Yeah, but it's cast,
so it's the same exact process. Saying, totally not a log though.
Yeah, but same from a short runner. You know,
they're not equal length though.
They're not equal length. They're like exactly that's what I'm saying. I'm using log as a differentiator from tubular and equal length. I know that still.
Hey, Mike, still my stick welded cast iron manifold is totally fine.
It's totally fine. Totally fine. But
I'm saying
stick welding.
Most people don't realize that it. They get so hung up on equal length and for radius as well. As you know, for pumping losses, like fluid flow, you have your variable. Every for how tight is the radius, changes your effective length. So there's more to it than just, well, what does the center line on the tube say? But also at the same time, like the tuning on these engines, you know, most
that's what I'm saying.
They're not that strung out that a slightly different pulse is going to complete throughout their next combustion cycle like Formula One would. Now, at the same time, it will jack up your individual, I'll say, fuel and performance per engine or per cylinder.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, there's going to be a duty cycle change between the fuel injectors if you're looking at it individually, for sure. I'm not saying there's not going to be hot and cold potentials between those, right? There's going to be the difference in duty cycle between those cylinders and injectors and such. But most people who are even just like generally tuning and building cars that are in the 600-800 horsepower range even right now, they don't have individual EGTs. They're not looking at individual O2s. They're not doing any of those things that would really even give them the answer that there is a problem.
It's good or bad or indifferent. Yep.
Right. They're just overfueling with alcohol-based fuels and using, you know, phase change and all these other things for the cooling perspective to keep detonation at bay when they're not even that necessarily close to det margin. And even if they are close to det margin, really doesn't matter because the ethanol basically mitigates all the bad things that you just did anyway. And that's why I like...
Then you're not running it hard enough. Yeah.
I'm not disagreeing with anything. I'm not disagreeing with that fact, but I'm saying that they're not that close to the edge. People think they stack up these parts and they're like super close to the edge, and they're not. And it's because other people have blown stuff up at that are you know, that horsepower or that really, you know, torque BMEP range and those types of things, or horsepower or RPM based because of rod stretch and bolt stretch and things like that. Right? There's different factors at different levels. Right? And we should talk about that. Actually, that's a good topic.
No, I completely agree. There's certain things that matter at a certain point and not others.
Yeah. Right. Right. But they're not, I'm saying they're not close to that limit. What happened to all those other cars that blew up at 600 horsepower that have the same configuration is that they were poorly tuned, had a bad cooling system, had a stuck injector, had some other problem that had nothing to do with the individual components.
Well, I mean, you can also have it where one cylinder is lean compared to the other, and you don't realize that you're going, well, my air fuels look great. Why did it blow up?
But that's my point,
cylinder
though,
one was lean because you realized it was going leaner than the rest.
But yeah, that's a bad, that's a bad part selection comparatively, right?
Well, your log manifold just screwed you.
Well, the log won't do as poorly as a poorly designed intake, which then would be terrible. But like on a turbo car, it's not going to be as problematic. It will be problematic in terms of, you know, scavenging, quote unquote scavenging, not the same thing, right? I hate that term, actually.
But that's just it. So if your log's sucky, you have more residual mass fraction from the last stroke in one cylinder.
See, I like that better. Yeah. Residual mass fraction. Good. Okay.
So I mean, it does jack up your combustion. It jacks up.
It can jack up the combustion. But again, they're probably not that close.
At the same time, this is probably
close to debt margin.
It would have been oil piston squirter. So, you know, whatever. Yeah.
That's a good point. Yes.
Could you repeat that? I missed that.
I said at the same time, it's probably a guy with an Evo who blocked off his piston squirters. So
yeah,
we did
that.
Yeah.
We actually put him back, but it's okay. It doesn't matter. Anyway.
Well, it was because we were using the 4G64 block.
And then, we drilled for him and stuff like that. We actually added them to a 4G64.
Yes,
But that's what I'm saying is a generality is that people aren't that close. And yes, there is circumstances where the log manifold can cause the differential between the cylinders to cause problems like that. But again, people generally aren't that close and they make other either part selection, tuning mistakes, those types of things.
Yeah, I'll say the only people I think in our industry are really that close are the guys who are serious about drag racing, the guys who are serious about time attack. Beyond that, most tuners are going to throw a tune on you, kind of get their best guess of MBT. I won't get started on lots of MBT tuning and all that sort of stuff. Go to about MBT and pull a couple degrees for safety and say, all right, send it. And that's it.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah, half of your customer losing 10 horsepower, they knew, one blowing shit up because you don't have individual cylinder EGTs and AFRs to at least get you tuned in. And for like a lot of guys, I suggest even if they have individual AFRs, they get expensive, they burn up, they pop, there's kind of
there's lots
there.
Of problems, yeah.
Have them along with the EGTs. And what you have is what your EGT should look like. Pull out the O2 sensors, and if something starts getting funky with your EGTs, you know something is up. Because there is the correlation between them. And, for our level, that's, before you get into, cylinder pressure sensors and all kinds of crazy stuff, that's pretty darn good. And so you don't have the always running cost of, I keep running up, air fuel sensors every freaking weekend.
And that's actually what we're doing. That's exactly what we're at.
Yeah.
Because that's, an appropriate way to kind of get as much data as you can without jumping to that next step, which is that cylinder pressure sensor.
Yeah.
So it's a hard thing to quantify. But anyway, I'm still on that train that log manifold is fine for most people. But there are obviously advantages to tubular manifolds. I'm not saying there's not advantages there. That especially well-designed ones. That's the key, right?
There's just advantages to well-designed manifolds.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. I was going to say that.
Yeah, like I've known Ben for years
like that.
At RTEC. Yeah. I mean, they make some nice stuff. They really do. They got a sharpener over there. Like I talked with Ben about RTEC stuff before, and I mean, it's pretty solid. It's actually something I had a very similar concept that I wanted to do with Subarus. Surprise! But of course, at the time, the cost is outrageously expensive to do. Stupid. So,
yeah, and that's the thing. So, and I have this other idea, and I've been annoyed by it. But for me, the more that I've been thinking about engines as a generality and tuned engines and things like that, or higher strung, I should say, engines that particularly have head gasket problems or abnormal or detonation problems that, let's say, they shouldn't have. Or only in one cylinder, those types of things, right? We know the factors that are involved there, right? Fuel flow, if you have differential injectors, right? If you have injectors that are flowing differently, if you have air that's flowing differently because of the manifold designs, we just talked about that. But one thing that is almost never accounted for and never even dealt with in almost every aftermarket car, any system that they built, is the cooling system. And so there are hot spots in every cooling system, and people just completely go, hey, this is the temperature it's at, and it's fine. Can you imagine you're looking at your engine, and you've got all these sensors, right? We're looking at, as a generality, even if you don't go crazy, you don't do individual EGTs, individual O2s, anything like that, but you're just tuning your engine. You still got a lot of data comparatively to any other system on the car, right? And especially the cooling system, because the only number you have on the cooling system is temperature.
Yep.
And that's
just smart that you put pressure on there too.
But that's so we have pressure sensors all over. But it's my point is like that all you really know is temperature. And so then people are like, yeah, the cooling system's relatively stock, or I put a bigger radiator in and everything's fine. It's like you are asking that system to diminish an incredible amount of heat comparatively. That heat rejection number goes up proportionally, sometimes disproportionately, to the horsepower that you make, right? So like if you have, technically, if you have a 400 horsepower car, that's a certain amount of heat rejection. If you have an 800 horsepower car, that's going to have double. But in some cases, there are going to be areas that are more affected because their inability to cool, because there is some latent heat, there is some volume-based issues of the heat making it out of the cylinder. So, right? Mm-hmm. So we're all used to valves need to be cooled back in the day and all that stuff, and people talk about that. But people don't think about the fact that your heads, especially, depending on the flow of the cooling system, so again, I got to qualify everything I say. The flow of the actual coolant, the direction of the coolant, the pressure of that coolant, and then how well the head was cast, generally, because they're going to be cast heads and not billet. Those particulate, right, the edges inside that casting, how sharp they are, how well they've been cleaned up, all those things will have an effect on how well your engine stays together, especially mm-hmm. when we're talking about head gaskets or otherwise.
Just as an interjection from the guy who likes to complain every now and then, I really hate when people just give me horsepower and tell me, hey,
right,
what size am I making this thing? What size do I make this radiator?
What's the thermal? What's the actual rejection, right? What's the thermal rejection?
What do you need?
How efficient
that is that? That makes me angry. I hate when they rate clutches and engine controls by horsepower. That's my real pet peeve.
Well, of course, engine guy, cooling guy. What are we talking? You guys are the same thing. You guys are complaining about the same problem.
Yep.
But
so I'll say one example, Mike, for that is in the Subaru world. My buddy Dom, we go way back. He does a cylinder 4 cooling mod, as they call it, and it's just for that.
Sure.
It is on one bank. You have coolant that flows out the back of the head and goes to the turbo. The other side, it's just a dead spot. And so he made some that essentially comes on the bypass, goes to the heater core. Yeah, and so it makes it so your heads are parallel.
It increases.
So some people do pay attention to it.
Promotes flow.
Yeah.
But there's but I'm saying even then, so high horsepower Subarus, right, or high Evos or whatever, right? So I'm
250 horsepower.
Yeah. The what I'm saying is like, so in your case, my case, whatever. So Subarus as a tendency, like, you know, we all know they blow head gaskets.
They
even
don't.
Stock ones have a tendency.
I don't know why people think they blow head gaskets. The only reason they blow head gaskets is people get an aftermarket block done with shitty surface finish or some didn't fall procedures right. The head gaskets are not the problem in Subaru.
I'm not saying.
Ringland's in an EJ25, hands down, I'll give it to you every day.
I'm not even saying tuned ones. I'm saying stock ones. You go to Portland and they're like 84 fucking Subaru places that are like, we can do head gaskets in 35 minutes. And so it's like.
You want to know why that is?
I mean,
we're
talking non turbo cars.
Subarus that actually had head gasket problems were the NA EJ25s. They came with awesome gaskets and those things.
Yep. That's what I'm talking about, though. Like, so they had head gasket problems at the time, right? And different things. But I'm saying, like, it from that respect, right? I'm saying that, like, thinking about how the cooling system works and thinking about the issues that come along with that, people just ignore the cooling system as a whole. They put all this money and energy. Like, how many people do you know that are like, I'm gonna put, let's say, even from Hayden's perspective, I'm gonna put my engine cost $25,000, $30,000, $40,000 after I literally bought everything that I could to make this thing make 600-800 horsepower, right? In a reliable sense, right?
Plastic tank, then, eBay shit, let's go.
Exactly. And so then, how, you know, what is a reasonable amount to spend on the cooling system that is literally keeping that bitch alive, right? Is it $1,000? Is it literally like 0.5, you know, 2%? Is it 5%? Is it 10%, right? If you have a $25,000 build, are you going to spend 10% on your cooling system so that you have a $2,500 cooling system that actually keeps the shit cool and you've actually designed it right and put some thought in it? Or you're just going to buy the fucking eBay tank, whatever, aluminum radiator that is fatter.
OBX.
Yeah, because it's 3 inches now instead of 2 inches. And now it's way better and it's going to handle your... biggest... What?
Well, I was going to turn them on the bus.
Easy.
Shitty moto and they're notoriously terrible quality, but yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Someone else really understands.
But my point is that, like, it's funny to me because nobody even thinks about it, and they put all this time and effort into the other side of it, and then they don't into the things that's keeping the engine alive. Like, the engine can't run without this.
We're talking about people that don't pay attention to a cooling system. Always blows my mind how people go to Pike's Peak and never think about the cooling system.
Oh, I mean anything.
Oh boy.
100% anything.
Well, on top of that, you take this thing, you're making this power. Oh, and it's low, you know. It's thin air.
You're on a mountain, dude. The mountain is cold. The mountain is cold.
Do you know that there's snow up there? Yeah, God, idiot. It's fog.
Yeah. The snow's going to cool your radiator. Great. Yeah.
If there's fog,
you look, haven't got a radiator, let's be honest.
It's more dense. But yeah, I mean, that comes into play, like, even not just cooling, but obviously brakes. And so people think about it in terms of performance. How can I continue to make performance, right? So they're looking at turbo. They increase turbo speed to keep making the pressure, right? Because if you have a target, the turbo is just going to continue to speed up. As you move to an altitude that is lower and the pressure decreases naturally, you're going to try to increase that pressure, which makes the turbo go faster. Fine. Okay. We understand that. But they get that from that perspective. But then they don't think about the fact that the radiator cooling is 30 to 50% less, or the brake cooling.
And the intercooler and everything else. Yeah. And your brake.
Right.
Yeah. How quickly can you get heat off of your rotors? Yeah.
Right. And so you don't get that thermal. So, like, right, when it's funny, you know, talking about brakes as well, people don't understand how brake temperature, right, or just temperature as a generality works in terms of thermodynamics, right? When you get on the brakes hard, you build that temperature. But the second you come off the brakes, you've got this peak temperature and you have this logarithmic. Is it logarithmic? Is that the word I'm looking for? Declining exponential function.
Well, let's go ahead and say for everybody, sawtooth. It's a sawtooth. It's going up and down.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm saying, so you hit a peak, and then you have an aggressive drop initially because you have the temperature of the air that you're cooling to.
Yeah, the pads
you
get
have
cold,
high
yeah.
temperature. And the difference between those, there is a rapid drop initially. And then as you get closer to the ambient temperature, right, that cooling slows because you don't, the delta T. Yeah. On that temperature is different, right?
Right.
And so people don't realize, like, you have this spike in brake temperature and then it comes off relatively quickly. And then you're like me, you know, let's say it's 1,000. These are arbitrary numbers. They're not exactly right. So do not stick to it. But let's say 1,000 F, right? Not that, right? So 1,000. And then it comes down relatively quickly to, let's say, closer to 500 and then starts to taper slower, right? It's not exactly how it works, but I'm trying to use it as an example. And people don't understand that that's like the functionality of how the brakes work. And so when they think about like how to cool a brake system, a lot of people will use forced air coolers with a lot of pressure. And what they're doing is taking that and they're forcing a bunch of air into it, which is cooling the brakes rapidly, right? And if you have a brake rotor that maybe isn't the best quality and then you force air cool it, what do you do in that situation? Or let's say, God forbid, there's a little bit of moisture around. What does that what happens to that system? You rapidly contract it and you crack the shit out of it.
Yep.
So people put these coolers on brake systems and then they're like, why is my rotor all messed up so quick? It's like, you're.
I will say, and on top of it, just thinking brake performance, one thing I like, the easy example for guys who are out there listening, Wilwood shows all the, basically their coefficient of friction for their pads along with the heat ranges for them on their website. Mm-hmm. It's quite nice. You can go look at them. And they're talking about in terms of sensitivity of what your actual brake temperatures are. That's another thing to take consideration. I mean, it happens in some of the longer streets in like F1 that we'll talk about it, where the brakes are cold, so they have to get on the brakes earlier because, well, your pad's not going to have any bite either. So it's not just the rotor.
Prepping the pad for for the initial action so that your actual bite is good.
Yeah.
And so, it's just interesting. Anyway, let's go back to engines because fuck that.
Just sticking on engines. So how does one... determine, I mean, this is not going to be probably applicable to grassroots, but at the F1 level or at the NASCAR level, how does one determine like the appropriate mass flow of coolant within an engine to cool properly, but also not have too much coolant flow that you're wasting energy?
I'll let you take a guess.
I mean,
trial and error?
Simulation. You have materials properties, you know what you're putting out heat rejection through. Combustion and at least have...
that's the definition of thermal efficiency. But you just qualified the definition of thermal efficiency, Dan.
And you know roughly how much heat's going out the exhaust and how much is going through of your oil and how much is going out your coolant. That's the other part people forget. Oil does a lot of cooling in the engine.
Yeah,
like,
I mean...
I always... Porsche guys are like, oh, it's an air-cooled Porsche. I'm like, nah, it's like 90% of that cooling is actually oil.
Yeah, it's oil-cooled, yeah. No, I agree. And I've tried to tell people from a cooling standpoint, in terms of cooling, there's convection, conduction, right? Your cooling system. Mm-hmm. Your cooling system could be like a third, right? So your cooling system is taking a third of the possible heat rejection. Your oil may be taking a third as well. Maybe a little bit less. It depends on the engine. It will go up and down depending on the engine configuration and all these things. So it can almost reject almost as much heat as your cooling system in some cases. It's not often, but it happens. And so people don't even realize that. And then they don't think about the fact that some of that heat rejection is going out the exhaust, and how you route that exhaust and where it's going does have an effect on how quickly and well the engine is rejecting that heat. So turbo cars hold the engine a little bit, hold the temperature a little bit more than something that's more NA that would distribute that heat more quickly. So
one thing people probably, most people probably have never thought about, the only way you get heat out of your piston, excluding fuel and air from the crown side, right? Because you have combustion on that side. You know, right. You'll get, you know, for instance, particularly like an ethanol engine, we have way more fuel and latent heat vaporization is great, and it cools down a lot more on the ground compared to, you know, say running 93 octane.
Anything else?
Gas.
Non-alcohol based fuels. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's get methanol in there. Yeah. But anyhow.
Yeah.
The only other thing that's cooling your piston is oil.
Is it
oil? And I say this in terms of you either have a layer around your skirt that is then transferring through the cylinder wall to your cooling system, and or it's oil spraying the bottom of your piston. I mean, you'll get slung oil as well. A lot of
not a ton. I mean,
no, it's not. It's really just crapshoot. You'll see a lot of connecting rods from OEMs where they have kind of slits at the top of your rod bearing grooves.
Right.
And that's just let excess oil go towards the piston, and kind of it's a spray
and
pray.
Picks it up and throws it.
It's a spray and pray approach. And some oil will get on a piston. That's great. It'll take the heat out of it. Other ones you'll see OEMs where they actually have a piston squirter in there. That piston squirter realistically only hits the piston part of the time. It doesn't have the pressure to drive it to top dead center. So you're not spraying the piston the entire time. When it's coming back down half bore, down around bottom dead center, that sort of stuff, it's spraying it and soaking it in oil, which is pulling the heat out of your piston, which allows it to be pushed harder. And you get way down this rabbit hole. You start getting into your profiles for the actual camber on a piston. Pistons aren't round, by the way. They're ovate from the top down. So you're looking at them, they're narrower across than they are along the pin axis. Pin axis wider. You know, from the side, they're kind of shaped like a barrel. So they have a taper to them because the crown gets hotter. So, you know, the ideal part is when it's all hot, it becomes round and straight. So your piston wall is the same. Your rings seal up great, this, that, and the other. If you have, you know, I want my daily driver Evo for, you know, 1,000 wheel horsepower build. Meanwhile, that piston that's going to be able to survive 1,000 wheel horsepower with the heat is going to be completely just flopping about in the daily driver situation because it's not hot enough.
And that's why, again, perfect point. That's why you need to warm up the engine when you have those types of situations and then those parts designs, right?
Yeah.
That's what the warm-up literally is doing, is making the system function the way it's supposed to be.
I've got a factory block heater on my forged piston daily driver, so when the weather gets cold, I plug it in.
Yeah, and that's the point. Like,
far down the rabbit hole.
What do you drive?
No, just a little bug-eye beater, a little WRX.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
no, a little 2-inch stroker ported head, some STI.
Just making sure it's dog shit to keep you.
Yeah, little EFR.
Keep you in line.
Yes, STI 6-speed, all that good. Just it's the beater. But yeah.
But that's and that's a great point. Like, you see some videos where people, they take a piston and they're rocking it, right, when it's cold. Like, it's just, you know, a short block, right? And they're like rocking the piston and people are like, oh my gosh. This is so crazy.
What do you think happens when it's cold? And you hear that piston slap. It's literally coming around top of the center and it's whacking off the,
Yeah, yep. People are—they just don't understand what they're looking at.
Do you have an opinion on the different piston materials?
Oh no, I wasn't. That's not where I'm going.
And what is it? Is it 2618 is the most common?
That's
right?
Your common
for aftermarket. And
4032 is the other one that's higher silicone. You can have a tighter piston wall with it due to its properties, but it's ultimately not going to take
silicone
abuse.
Yeah, silicone material less tendency to expand.
But since seemingly, you know, in the aftermarket, the engines just aren't remotely optimized anyway. Are they strong enough, the 4032?
It really depends on application and design.
Sure.
I mean, you could do a boxed or strutted design 4032 that's, you know, like for a Subaru guy, I'd properly design proper piston wall, that sort of stuff. I wouldn't push it past probably 400 horsepower on EJ25. Like, it's just
fair.
It's just not really suited for it. It's the guy
because of the embrittlement or what?
It doesn't do well with high heat. That's the thing most people don't realize. Looking at data that most people find in terms of like yield strength and ultimate strength. So for those that don't know, and Mike, of course, you know, anyone listening, you probably has a general idea. When you do stress strain curve of a given material, what you do is you go, all right, well, it goes and you have this nice ramp rate that goes up and it's going and increasing. You go, all right, for this much force we're putting on it, it's deflecting this much. And it kind of gets to the point where it has what's called a knee. And that's where you get to yield. It's where it kind of breaks over. So think of like taking a paper clip and you could take it and you could kind of pull it and slide over a piece of paper and it's not permanently deformed. But you put it over too big of a stack of piece of paper and it becomes bent. You have exceeded its yield strength and it is now permanently deformed. And once you go past that point, you're heading towards ultimate. But so when you're looking at these nerdy graphs, they're always done at essentially some controlled lab temperature, right? Basically room temperature. What happens when you start looking at materials
pressure.
When you start getting materials at elevated temperatures, those strengths change drastically. Like 70-75, for instance, you would never use for a piston. It completely just nosedives at elevated temperatures where you'd have a piston operating. So that's why you use 2618 or, you know, 2040-2099, all kinds of 2000 series. They have copper. They're great at heat transfer. They do better with high heat in comparison. And so meanwhile, in a relatively lower temperature thing, like they use them in aerospace all the time, that's usually aerospace, you know, aluminum. It's usually 7,000 series because it does really well so long as it's not hot. The hot parts in a jet are usually going to be some high nickel, you know, type of material like Inconel or Wasp alloy or some other exotic things, Rene 41 or something else. And so the 4032 is great. So for instance, Grandpa's 302 Mustang, they put high compression pistons in, this, that, and the other. Yeah, 4032 is probably great. It's not making much power per hole. It'll still drive a lot in terms of, you know, a hyper-eutectic type or cast piston where it's a nice piston wall, very straight, low noise on startup. You're not going to have that piston slap. Its thermal expansion isn't as much. So you don't have that big, that rocking at the top as much because it doesn't have to have as much taper. So there's some pros to it, but it just doesn't take the abuse. So when you throw a turbo at it and your combustion is that hot and you can't get the heat out fast enough, it gets hot and it gets soft and you blow a hole through it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. Like for the people listening, when he was talking about different numbers, those are alloying, right? So there's different alloying materials. And so you can go check that out in terms of different numbers and what those numbers mean. Like you said, the 2000 series generally has some nickel, some copper. You know, your 6000 series are a little bit stronger. Your 6 and 7 are considered more structural based. 7 is the aircraft, like you said. And so it's just
Firecall 7,
alloys.
I think, is magnesium, which is also why you can't weld it Firecall. But yeah, where it's very hard to weld, or it'll micro crack. But yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You have the heat affected zones start to turn into fissures and then you.
And I think 8,000 is like general whatever. So like tin foil is actually aluminum, but the tin is the alloying agent in it. That's why they call it tin foil.
Yep.
Even though it's aluminum.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So just looking at the different alloying perspectives, right, in terms of metallurgy will give you different properties. And that's why when you're talking about the 4000 series and we're talking about the addition of silicon to the alloying material, the silica base has less tendency to expand. And that's what, you know, that covers what he was talking about in terms of putting it in a normal car, right? That's something you're used to, more of a cast piston, a hyper-eutectic piston. It will work better in that situation because it has less tendency to expand. So it means that it's got a more rigid volume and it doesn't have to go small to large, which means that you can make it more true to shape even at room temperature, because it's not going to expand and change shape and then get stuck, if you will, in the hole like something else if you were to make the geometry too large. I'm just trying to qualify and help everybody understand the base background of everything you just said.
It's interesting because how much of that also applies in my world where X material can be used in this situation for brazing and how...
Yeah, brazing. Yeah, that's a big one.
One to the other. Everything we use is 3003.
Yes. And 3003 is more malleable.
Right.
Yeah, 3003 is really,
it's easier to
really
form.
Common.
Yeah.
Cladding material.
And so, people don't realize that aluminum is not aluminum. Aluminum is about 1,000 different materials, depending on which one you choose. They are all different. Very, very, very different. They just
Same with steel, same with anything aluminum. Where you just throw a general name at something. But yeah.
Right. Yeah. There's about a billion options for almost, exactly. Any alloying material, holy shit. There's about a billion options.
Like you need like when you say aluminum, 1000 series aluminum is aluminum and it's putty.
You touch it, bend it
with your hand, like roll it over. It's like sheet of aluminum and you just took your thumb and whoop and I bent the corner. Yeah, it's soft.
Yeah, it's very malleable.
And it's very nice.
Yeah, aluminium.
Oh, yeah.
They're talking about aluminium strength and plastic.
Effect. Yep.
So
they literally spell it differently than we do across the pond.
Well, that's how they.
Yeah, want to and do down it. Under, they're freaking freaks.
Yeah, and when you explain to them that the original colony, Latin,
what are you going
to
do?
The original Latin's aluminum, so you win the argument every time. Yeah.
I didn't know that. That's a good argument right there, idiots.
Yep.
Anyway, going back to engines, the other thing that I was thinking that Dan was going to ask, but he didn't ask, because he loves to ask this question.
Maybe he didn't get to it because you've been talking so much.
It could be, but he's not going to get to it now because I'm going to get to it.
I'm gonna get to soccer. Was it originally an English word? So
it was associated soccer. That's what it was actually called.
You're correct.
Yes, it's called. I know all that too. Don't worry. I got grilled about everything Americanized. Wait,
what did you just say?
It was soccer was originally called associated soccer. It was associated football, and so they called it football. We stuck with the associated part, and ended up calling soccer. So we got soccer, and they got football from it. It was associated football. The original sport was called associated football.
Whatever. Anyway, that seems ridiculous.
Mind blown.
I'll think about that one later. But in terms of the question that Dan always asked that didn't ask, is piston to wall clearance, and is there any weird secret sauce that isn't the same in F1 that, you know, obviously you can't, if you can't answer, whatever. But the comparatively to what you would do in something like Turning Concepts engine that you helped design, all that stuff, or even the NASCAR engines, is there any different material, different rings, different something that makes that calculation different?
Well,
is it better machined because there's tighter tolerances? Is there what are the factors here?
So it's essentially the same problem. Even if you use a different material, it's still the same issue, right? All right, this is what it is when you assemble it cold. This is what it's going to be when it's hot. This is the shape we want it to have. This is how tight we want it to be in operation. So that's really what you all think design is, particularly being on the performance side for modeling. The crevice volume you have is something you pay huge attention to. But yeah, so the piston or wall stuff, it's all the same. It comes down to materials and how quickly can you heat out a piston.
Is there any crazy exotic ring material that's not what wouldn't be used otherwise?
I'll say nothing outrageous. No, nothing outrageous. I mean, so for instance, Red Bull, when I was there, Formula One had initially for 26 wanted to get rid of steel pistons. Audi and Volkswagen came in fussing about how much steel pistons cost, and they knew it's from their LMP1 program, blah, blah, blah. And of course, Mercedes is like, we make ours all in-house. They're super cheap. And then you have Ferrari having to buy them from Mahle at an eye-watering amount because they're their sponsor, but they agreed to it, and so they've got a co-op thing. Then, like, you have all these people yelling about steel pistons, so we had to use aluminum pistons initially. Then, of course, we went to a well-known Austrian manufacturer for some bits that a lot of people go to. And so, of course, the machining quality done to it is far higher. If I recall, the amount of time, I think it's 60 hours per piston.
Wow.
On the mill.
Holy shit.
That's just on the mill.
That's insane.
Jesus.
That's before it goes off for any type of coating. That's before any of the rest of it's done. 60 hours on the mill.
Is there any interesting coatings?
You can name it. There's some proprietary ones I won't get into. I'll say electroless nickel with some other stuff done to it is done. Performs quite well. You'll see DLC coated.
Skirting?
You'll see DLC on the skirts. That's pretty standard.
Yeah, okay. That's cool.
What
does it do? What are they doing for 60 hours? Is it like just pocketing and radiusing to that, that degree?
Yeah, we crazy undercuts getting weight out of every little spot you don't need it. They're pretty intricate. And of course, then as we call out, your tolerances on it are also quite tight too. So if you ever look at a piston drawing, I mean, it's almost like you have an entire grid of inspection points you put on the thing for the profile that you have.
Ooh,
And then on top of that, you then have all your grooves that are very tight because you have little things going on there that you want done for the given ring pack you have and how it's supposed to behave.
Sure.
What kind of tolerances do you have on an F1 piston?
We do everything in micron, so it's full stuff.
Oof.
I mean, not different than you'd expect for anything else, just performance aftermarket.
Just
everything
a little tighter.
Because you don't want to pay for it. Ultimately, that's what it comes down to. People want to spend $600 on a set of pistons. I held a single piston that was 4,000 pounds. Put that in perspective.
And that's dollars.
That's $5,000-ish right now.
He's not that strong. He can't hold 4,000 pounds at one
hand. Would you fucking talk American? God damn it.
So there. It's about 5,000. I could say
communist shit.
But yeah, so...
Dude is a stacked brick house. He's doing fucking lat raises with a 4,000-pound piston.
I was thinking it too. Like, yo, you fucking yoke over there.
So we're building boats.
Oh my god.
So yeah, big boats.
Ships. Yeah.
So yeah, $5,000 for a piston. Yeah. That gives you an idea. I mean, when people say how much do you want to spend, like really, how much do you want to spend?
And you're right. You're right.
And there comes a point, and it comes a point where it crosses over. So, for instance, I'm doing a lot of this McLaren engine stuff now, where I'm treating it much more like an actual race engine. You know, going through and CT scanning all the heads and all the casting parts to make sure they're good. You know, do a pre, basically torque thing up. It goes to the CMM, gets measured at a time, comes back, gets torn down, bearings go in it.
Have a CT
gets torqued back up again. Goes to the CMM,
You have a CT scanner for that?
Not my own, though.
You get it. Okay, so you get it.
I know people. Okay. I know people. Yeah,
yeah. It's like F1. Like, what do you?
I understand. Australia has the CT scanner for our radiators.
What is literally called Race City USA?
Oh, okay.
We have everything here.
That's wild. I'm just like jumping out of the CTL. Like, I'm just like, oh, I got a lump. I'm gonna go see what's going on.
Meanwhile, you're like for health insurance. I can't afford to get a CT scan done.
Exactly.
But I'm gonna slice this cylinder head every quarter millimeter and see everything.
Exactly, and then go look. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, this is a debate between race cars and health insurance.
What's more important?
States right here. Yeah. Right. Exactly. I'm just getting on the table.
At the same
time.
So, for instance, I'm using it for them because what McLaren engines go for, I can put all this extra stuff in that the factory doesn't. Because I'm not McLaren, so I'm not going to put a McLaren tax on the thing. I'm literally putting the money into all the stuff goes into it, so I can slap a warranty on this and tell you to go make 1,200 wheel horsepower and have a good day.
Yeah, sure.
No, but that's a separate thing. And when you're putting a warranty on 1,200 horsepower, that you're going to give to some guy to go, the G side of you, make sure everything's right.
And as you alluded to, so that the listeners understand that when you're making an OE design, like a true OE design, what you're doing is you make the design with the tolerancing that you think is required. And then you loosen up the tolerances as much as you possibly can until it doesn't function the way that you want it to anymore and will not reliability targets. And then you go back a little bit and then you buy that part and you make that part. That's how it works.
Like, most people don't realize, like, OEM. Well, so I hated OEM, it was super slow. Like, I got in trouble for being bored. But at the same time, there's real engineering that goes into it. It's essentially designed inferiority. How crappy of a thing can you make and it still does its job?
Right, but people don't understand that that's not an easy thing to do either.
No, so
people
it's not.
Planned obsolescence, those types of things. Like, yes, that's kind of true to an extent that we've become better at engineering. So we've become better at prediction. Right, that's what we're really doing. We're doing better at testing and prediction.
I did a stint at Volvo Penta for their gas engine line. So this is we're partnered with them on their early Gen 5 GM stuff, all the LT1s and all that sort of crap they're going through and doing their beta and gamma ranges and all that sort of stuff and. I told all my friends, much like I did with, like, the Voodoo, the GT350 laters, like, don't buy one. Like, let them sort out their issues. It's same with the early LT1 stuff. I was like, dude, they're snapping rod bolts and cranks are breaking and all kinds of, like, don't. Now, marine applications are extremely abusive. I mean, you're at full load anytime. There's no part throttle. It's you're in or you're out of it, basically.
Comparatively.
Loaded up. But,
cost anything savings, from Mercury is, they test way harder.
So for cost savings, they had wanted to go to a plastic oil filter adapter housing. So, of course, you take a car engine and put it into a boat, you can't just crawl under it and get an oil filter, right? So you basically have to remount, relocate and remote mount the oil filter, put it on the front, we put it on the front FIAD. For those that know FIADs, since you're front end accessory drive, so are your serpentine belt and your water pump and all that sort of crap's on the front, that's where it went. But for the housing to go on where the oil filter went, they wanted to make it out of plastic for cost savings. I'm going, guys, you guys have how bad of an idea this is, right? When this fails, it's not like, oh, darn, let me call the dealership and get another part. It's, oh, darn, let me call the dealership and get another $30,000 engine.
Like, and they want to make it out of PA66 to get embrittlement, due to oil egress and everything like that.
Oh, my goodness,
just for fun, right? Just for fun.
Good times.
There's a lot of good engineers, and they're quite good engineers doing OE things like this. And I generally, like I said, we've talked about this before, use OE parts whenever possible for a lot of things, because the basis is that their testing is better, right? Aftermarket testing is not good. It just is what it is. They just, people don't have the test facility.
Hey, don't
and the
throw
capability.
Us all in the same thing.
I'm not throwing you under that bus. Calm down there, big guy. I'm saying that as a generality.
Yeah.
You understand, right, that competitors and other people don't really have one. The testing thought process, the engineering thought process from an OE level, right? You have an OE level thought process. It's a different thing, right? It is a very different thing because you have to meet these requirements that are so much more developed in terms of you know, what is potential warranty, what is not. All these things are thought about way early on in the process. And it's just not a normal thought process for most people, especially in the aftermarket world.
Simple example, right? So guys are like, oh, we have testing done on this side or the other. Example, I won't say who in the Subaru community, you know, a rotated turbo kit, right? Oh, yeah, they got a great name, blah, blah, blah. They had just, and this one on the such and such drag car. Well, to give you an idea, like you'll cry here, it's a heavy manifold with a big, heavy turbo on it, and there's no support brackets for it anywhere.
Right.
Why do I keep pulling out exhaust gaskets?
What?
Why do I keep getting cracks in things? Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, they did their testing, and they went really fast on this one car and this other car, so, yeah, clearly I had to buy it. But, like, just...
Right.
And even that's just
that's not durability. That's performance.
Zero durability testing done.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And that's the thing that people don't realize is that there is a big difference between those two. And like I said, from an OE perspective, most aftermarket companies are incapable of testing durability. They can test performance. I'm not saying that lots of people don't test performance. That's a fine thing. They can test that. But that's not where reliability comes from, right? It's not a performance-based metric. It's a reliability-based metric.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm not saying that they're terrible people or anything like that. It's hard. It is very difficult to test reliability.
And that's, honestly, one of the biggest
things. And
they
won't do it.
It's in the racing world, particularly as an engine guy. In the racing world, no one ever thinks the engine guy. The only time you hear the engine guy mentioned is if an engine blows up.
Yeah, it is.
Durability is absolutely 100%. Critical. If you have an engine blow up, you have a Grand Prix, an engine blow up, you pulled a Ferrari and the thing pops, do you become the laughingstock about this? You know,
right.
But,
constantly.
Yeah, and yes. One thing at Yates, an engine failure was completely unacceptable. It could not happen.
Right. And that's what, from that level of organization but that was a predetermined, right, requirement, and is how close you can get to that edge to build something that had that reliability target.
And the part,
it took them 40 years to get there.
Yeah, sure. And there's a lot of background.
Well, now I've got all kinds of simulation and test cells, and you run stuff, do entire simulation races on the engine ahead of time, all sort of stuff.
On the NASCAR stuff, it's interesting to me. Like, where, you know, obviously there's a lot of good old boy tech. All that good old boy kind of stuff has been falling away for the last, say, 10, 15 years.
20.
And now we're starting to move, 20, fine, into the new stuff, right? They're getting all these facilities. They're doing all this stuff. They're like, you know, how does the car feel? And now they're like shaker rigs. And so they're very different things, right?
Yeah, so they've had the shaker rigs for a while. It was really the boom in the early 2000s, really, when NASCAR got money and all of a sudden said, you know what? We can hire some smart people to bring in some more equipment here.
Yeah.
So it really started changing.
It's just interesting. That whole thing is super interesting.
It's very interesting
because it went from
how much I've been working with Hendrix, and they just bring a problem out and... wow, we're chasing 0.1% out of this cooler in given situations. Like, this is kind of ridiculous, guys. This is NASCAR.
Yeah, this is NASCAR. What are you guys doing?
So the thing that gets me is NASCAR still purposely stays so low tech. It's frustrating to me. Like,
stays what? Say that again?
So low tech.
Low tech. Yeah. I agree, but that's what I'm saying. Like Dan said, it's 40 years, more than that, 70 years almost, of iterations based on an old design, and now they've gotten better.
Yeah.
And then they brought in these tools now that it's, you know, like it is such this dichotomy between these old good old boys who you have that old, you know, old dude, your grandpa or whatever, your dad, whatever your age may be, but he's out there listening, and then the car drives by, he's like, hey, it's misfiring on cylinder 7. And like, you know what I mean? Like, there's no data. It's just the fucking dude with his ear
in the corner. You're like, what?
Yeah. Right? And that dude's almost dead, and he's got Alzheimer's, but he's right. It probably is misfiring.
Well, but you can also eyeball the right cam profile to put into the engine for a given situation.
Exactly. Eyeball it, right? Yeah. He doesn't put it in the
$25,000 software suite just to do cam profiles.
Yeah. He doesn't do any of those things. No. And he doesn't put it in the tester or anything to just ensure. People don't understand how hard it is to measure a cam. It's hard to measure a cam. Anyway, we don't do any of that. And that's the thing. So it's like this old tech, you got all these old guys, all this old tech. And then they've now, like you said, had some money, brought in some new tech. And it's such an interesting world between the two, where there's like this fight between, you know, the old school thought, the new school thought, where do we want to go? How do we want to do it? Right. There's a ton of still analog around, low tech analog around. But then now they're like, we have ECUs. And everyone else is like, welcome. yay.
Yeah.
And so it's just a funny thing to me.
And it's another thing. You can spend a lot of money on a machine that literally just does camshaft measurements.
I did that. I had a cam measuring machine because I worked with cams in power steering pumps, right? So the opposite measurement, it's the, you know, interior measurement on inside of a power steering pump, but it's the same measuring equipment. And it's difficult to measure. It is to do it accurately and well, repeatable. It's not the easiest thing in the world to do. So there are some differentiations there, but it's like NASCAR spent how many years making a carb like perfect, as perfect as it can be, right? And then they got fuel injection and they're like, this shit sucks.
No, that's actually not how that went down. What happened is, so a few years prior is when NASCAR let everybody finally design like a race intent, not OEM based V8. So the game kind of set rules, and that's when the FR7, all those sorts of ones came out. Everybody had their different, you know, their FR9 and RO7, all the other, you know, whatever they GM named their thing and Ford named their thing and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So they had a specific thing and their own castings and blah, blah, blah. This is going to be our proper race heads and race block and, you know, this sort of thing. It's not based off of 351 anymore or an old, you know, small box Chevy.
Yeah.
So they went ahead and let them do this. And then I think it was 07 is when those came out. 05 is when they gave them the green light or something. Anyhow.
They're still trying to find those engines.
And in 2012 is when they bring in fuel injection. So what happened is they said, oh, you can have electronic fuel injection now. Everybody's pointing at everybody else's pack saying, well, they'll have an advantage because they're spraying the cylinder, blah, 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 this, that, and the other. And so NASCAR's like, fine, they make everybody happy so nobody can have this working properly. They ran the injectors way up the runners. So they're essentially electric carburetors. I mean, not that bad.
Right, yeah.
But it's really, really dumb.
It's plenum sprayed instead of almost, it's not quite.
Yeah,
but it's almost plenum spraying instead of.
Yeah, at least at the top runner. You're straight.
What's that? TPI?
Yeah, throttle port injection.
Toilet bowl injection.
Yeah, so.
Toilet bowl injection.
I'll say one thing that I will say I wish everyone did, and there were several times where I want to get on this thing. Grassroots Motorsports guys, why don't guys do oil analysis? It's the simplest way to know when your engine needs to have serious service.
So with that in mind, great, awesome. Who do you want to send it to? Because I don't like Blackstone.
Blackstone's the easy one that most people know. I can't think of them.
Who said it to otherwise?
Well, I can't. There was I'm brave for it right now. There's one that's down here. It's
But it's like $70 or $80
Lake Speed, whatever's
name. $20 or something.
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah.
Blackstone's easy enough, dude. If you see copper, you go, all right, shit, I've wiped all the coating off my bearing. If you get real nerdy about it, I mean, spectroscopy. So you could technically send it in numerous labs to be done. The problem is don't have an expert going through what's in it. And when you work at my level where I've been, where I have contacts, I know what goes in which bearings, what coatings are where. So I have literally PPM counts and I can kind of do a quick calculation roughly how much life I have left in what bearing. Because I know the total PPM counts I've had across every oil change that's been done. So
here's the thing, Micah.
That's what I did at CAT. Exactly what you're talking about. I could tell you how much was left on the bearings. We would literally clock it until I'd go, that shit needs a bearing change.
But.
And then for a regular guy.
I was going to say, your $8,000 Subaru owner that's just clapping it on track.
And you send it to
Blackstone. No.
My whole thing is send it to Blackstone. Yeah. I'm curious. What don't you like about Blackstone?
No, I'm not saying.
Shut
up, Mike.
I'm the one.
Shut up, Mike.
Stop talking!
Shut up, Mike. How many, grassroots guys haven't figured out how to make a high horsepower car survive more than one event. there is no point in oil analysis when the shit blows up every weekend.
Well, no.
And that's kind of not
you've got a guy who's out there tracking up. Your regular guy who's out there tracking a 300 to 400 wheel horsepower Evo or Subaru, that sort of thing.
Gotcha.
Crazy. Fair enough. They just like going out, they do HPDs or they're running, you know, ST3 with NAS or ST4 or some shit like that. And it's a basic maintenance thing. All right, how many seasons can I run before I really need to tear down my engine? Or a long time. A customer of mine from way back, actually friend at this point, Tim White, he runs national level autocross, he runs street mod in his Subaru. Obviously, how we got to know each other, he has other cars that he plays with too. But he's got a monster Subaru, it runs an EFR 6758. I won't say how much torque he makes. I'll say a shit ton of torque for a little 2.5 and a stock location turbo. But it's hard on internals, and things become fatigue life. Like, he used to run my rods, I told him, he started kept cranking up, I'm like, you're gone beyond these rods, I don't trust them anymore, they're a time bomb. Like, it was a 480-gram rod that it had. It was a 300-gram rod. Super lightweight, because we went out of time. Then he went ahead and started outputting about 50% more torque at low RPM. And well, yeah, dude, no. you need some like drag rods. He's like, really? I was like, no, seriously, solar pressure, the way it works, like, you need drag racing rods. The beefiest freaking I-beams you can get, go.
Hi, Devin chiming in here. To keep us out of trouble, a couple of things are about to be redacted.
Because they're just going to be some boat anchor thing that they designed and it'll take abuse. And he's at the point now, billet cranks. he's fatiguing and cracking billet cranks. Because, again, a 4340 crank's not up for it. EN40D might be, but it's cost for that's, you know, you're talking $4,000 or $5,000 for a crank now. Not, you know, the $1,000 to $2,000 range that you'd have for a billet crank. We're not $300 you could have for OEM. So you start getting this stuff. But meanwhile, you snap a crank, everything's trash. You know, you get three seasons or how many hours you have runtime out of a given component. It's a lot cheaper to stop it and do a rebuild and throw it away and buy another thousand.
Redacted.
Take your pick, any of them. A lot of them are Chinese parts that come over here and are finished stateside and they tell you.
Would you quit it?
Just burn it.
Yeah, finished in the U.S. Burn them all. We're aware.
Tell them what it is. I can send you their suppliers. Anyhow, the thing you get to is when you start doing this sort of actual analytical approach, particularly when you're not like constantly turning up the wick more, like, oh, this season I'm making 200 more wheel horsepower, because that makes it a total guessing game. You don't really know where you were without having someone like me or Mike with the cylinder pressure data to say, this is where you were. Now you're this much higher stress. This is where your fatigue life has now shifted to. You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Oh, your 75% of your life was on this, but now you're making this much more power. We know that we can calculate and say, all right, you've got about this much runtime left before that rod completely just improperly ventilates your crankcase. It's not black magic. There are ways to calculate this. And so if you have a serious program, it's probably worthwhile to invest a little bit of money to save yourself a lot of money. And I think, for instance, I go back to the Cosworth, the Sierra, that whole thing.
Yeah.
How many things they blew up had just a fraction of that level of engineering been done on the design side? You know, it would have helped a lot, I think. But of course, they just churned through how many Cosworth blocks and it became very expensive.
Yep.
So for your grassroots guy, the 300, 400 horsepower guy, getting your bearings read, it's an extra, what, I think Blackstone's maybe $15 now for analysis. I can't remember.
$20.
Is it 20 now? Relatively, it was still cheap.
It might be more now, but whatever. Anyway, Blackstone, I don't have a general problem with Blackstone. The reason why they're not my favorite, let's say, is because they are offering a service that's a dime a dozen. They're not putting a lot of time and energy into it. And there's been some irregularities in terms of the reports that I've received over time from different people. And so they're actually Fort Wayne. Shit, we should go talk to them. Actually, that'd be actually really cool. On the list.
I'm curious. Irregularities in like what kind of way?
Like one would have copper and the next one has none of it. Like that's an impossibility unless the bearings are fucking gone. Then the coating's gone.
I agree. The same car, same everything. Oh, we're getting copper. And then next time you go through, they're like, there's no signs of copper. Like, what?
Right. And that's my point. So there's just a little bit of irregularity there. And this was, I'm going to say this 100%, that this was 10 plus years ago now. Okay.
Okay.
Maybe a little less than that, but whatever. It was a while ago. And so some things like that where I'm like, if you send it and you tell them it's the same car, they'll put multiple reports next to each other so you can see the progression. And that's really helpful. But then when I see a progression that says copper, no copper, right? And I see that and I'm like, okay, that's a simple one, right? That's a very, you and I know that this is a very simple what the fuck moment.
Yeah.
This doesn't make a lot of sense because this engine should be removed right now and we should be taking a look at what's in there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's,
if you saw copper, that's when this should have happened, but yeah.
But but you know, it'll live a little bit longer. Yep. It'll live a little bit longer. But my point too is that on the other side of it, what people often mistake, there needs to be a little bit of knowledge when you do this because one, you have to do it from almost first start, right? Mm-hmm. You need to have that base level to understand, but you also need to understand what constituent materials are coming off due to wear in and what is good and what is bad. And so there is a little bit of knowledge that needs to be imparted into the person for doing it. And it's not saying that that's not something they can get done, right? We can help, you can help. People who have this knowledge can absolutely help what is important to look for and what is not. What is just kind of wear-in material based on rings, right? Those types of things. And a little bit of coating off the bearings is going to happen.
I mean, like, especially your first change, you're going to have all kinds of junk in there from all your, you know, assembly lubes and everything else. But yeah.
Right. Technicolor Dream Coat is going to happen at least a little bit. You have to understand that. And then you have to understand the consistency of the material that's coming out of it. And all these things are important. And for me,
it's just not well known what you're looking for, what's bad, what's good, what I should actually look for on these tracking reports. And that's where a lot of mistakes are made. And then the other side of it is that if you hadn't done it from the start, now you're only looking really, you only have these key
indicators. You're looking for the red flag now, basically, yeah.
Right.
Yep.
And it's mostly, uh-oh, moments, not this is progressively getting worse. I don't like that what I see, you know what I mean? It's like, that's bad.
Yeah.
And that's, you know what I mean? It's kind of not the same thing again. So it's hard for me, like, I
100% agree. You're telling me I need to start a YouTube series to explain this stuff and show people how to do it for themselves.
Awesome. Yeah. Something. I mean,
I already sent you a message. You need to do it on our blog post, our tech support post.
Yeah, we'll put it on our website.
Send me a message where?
We can.
On Facebook.
All right. Yeah, headphones on.
We should have a conversation about it, honestly. If you want to put anything on our blog and stuff like that, awesome. If you don't, you know, screw you. But the
fuck this game,
fuck this bitch. But the point is that you're 100% right. But again, it sucks that people need just like a modicum of information to understand what they're looking at, because then otherwise they just do stupid shit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it just drives me insane. And on top of that, if you start changing oils and ad packs, like, you know what I mean? Like if you're not consistent with your Mobil 1 or your AMSOIL or whatever you use,
yep,
and you're not consistent with the base stock of what that oil is with the particular ad packs, there can be confounding factors in there,
yep,
that will have a potential to change your results, and then people won't understand that either. So there's a consistency basis there that's super important as well.
Yep.
But I think that we should potentially have a conversation with Blackstone and different oils analysis and all this other stuff if they're willing, or someone like that. But yeah, that's where my qualifier comes in for all those things. And so there's another company, and I forgot what it was called. I was trying to find it, that does a little bit more in depth. Like, it's not Blackstone does a volume, right? They're more volume based seemingly. I'm not saying that's bad, but they're really trying to be the person for like an everyday user comparatively to if you have a program that's high enough, right? Good enough.
Right.
That there's companies that will do that spectral analysis is the word I'm looking for, right? They'll do a spectral analysis of the actual material and give you something that's much more concrete and much more accurate.
Speed Diagnostics, that's the Lake Speed Junior one.
Sure, sure. Yeah. We did a bunch of that oil analysis at CAT, and they had the equipment to do it, right? Because obviously,
yeah, we had it on site. You take it, gun on the hallway, burn it off,
right?
Exactly. See what you come out, but yep. Yeah.
So everyone, send all your oil in plastic bags to Mike, and he's got friends at CAT. He'll do it for you.
Yeah, it's
unlabeled.
Unlabeled.
Yeah, whatever you want.
Yeah, just put them in a flat rate box or a flat rate bag.
Mix it with dip fluid too. Fuck it.
Put the flat rate bag. The flat rate bag will be better. It'll hold it in better, I think, than the box. but that's the thing. So yeah, I'm with you 100%. And from
your own mass spectrometer, Mike.
It's a good idea.
There you go. You got a side hustle now.
You just want me to buy? Actually, I saw one for sale on like
GovDeals.
What's it called? Like GovDeals.
Yep, it. Yep. Ah, I see that stuff all the time. So my wife was in the craft brewing world. So you know, mass spectrometers are a thing. But it's one of those. You go. You know, I see one GovDeals. I'm like,
GovDeals.
You know, University of Florida is getting rid of a mass spectrometer.
Right, exactly.
I would love to. I'm going to put it in my garage.
And then doing the testing appropriately is not easy either.
Yeah.
And so there's upkeep and there's things you need, but it's hilarious. Like, it would be pretty funny to do that.
So the next things I'll buy is a CT scanner and a mass spectrometer. Right. Yeah. Good times.
Yeah, just right off of some old university's floor that they messed up. But there's a lot of stuff that comes out of Purdue like that. It's actually interesting.
A lot of universities get them. It's pretty wild.
Yeah. I check Purdue's stuff all the time to see what they have, because we bought some stuff off of them I bought
some cabinets. I saw Spintron on there. It was the university was getting rid of a Spintron that they had, I guess, for research.
No shit?
Yeah.
Hold on. Listen, you nerds. All right, we are
down the rabbit hole.
Running fucking long.
This is all good information. Everybody do not go on GovDeals and look for these things because they're ours. Get off it.
Unless you know what to do with it, you're kind of lost anyway, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, GovDeals kind of sucks as a website.
Well,
all right, sorry, Debbie.
We didn't even get into rules books yet, and the new turbo rule for street class.
No, we're gonna bring you back. We're gonna bring you back. Calm down,
relax. So obviously, I always leave with the last two questions. All right, so as we wrap this up, two questions I always ask everybody is, if you had one bit of advice for someone that wants to be like you, what would it be?
Oh. Serious answer, not sarcastic. I'm a guy who was a tinkerer since I was a kid. We kind of destined to go the engineer route. Just made sense. Went down that rabbit hole, did Formula SAE through all 4 years of college. Went off from there and started my own business and kind of worked my way up through the OEM world, just growing my skill set as a design engineer. You have what you need to chops to go do motorsports, at least in the U.S., because they don't design, you know, don't pick people up fresh out of college usually. And so, yeah, it's kind of a stepping stone to get there stateside. If you're good enough and international enough to go ahead and hop on over to Formula One where they hire armies of engineers, go for it. You will not regret it. It is cool. It is eye-opening. It's a totally different adventure. But honestly, it's just I'm a guy who constantly wants to tinker and play with something new. So just kind of follow your own path with that.
I think you kind of answered it, but the second question is, what keeps you doing what you do?
Yep, and I kind of answered that. Tinker, it's always the next project, the next something. I've been diving back in, for instance, you know, been doing enough engine stuff, diving back into suspension stuff because I haven't played with that since I was doing my motorsports engineering minor back in college. So been tinkering around with that some more lately. It's just something to play with. So,
well, for the folks at home, where can they find you or see your work? Or
yeah, because
besides our blog,
you have your own consultation company. What's that called?
3MI Racing.
There you go. And then where can we, if you want people to find you, if you don't, you don't have
so
to.
So you got 3MI Racing on Facebook. You can also find it on Instagram, although, you know, neither of those get used highly because they don't really have a lot to show when you're doing consulting. And then also you can find me at Ginger Micah on Instagram. Just Ginger Micah, no space, no underscore, no.
Well, now you told them you're Ginger. That was such you waited an hour and 40 minutes and now you dropped the bad news.
I baited them. Got them all.
Oh, my
got
God.
Him. Catfishing.
Got them.
Can't trust this guy.
But, yeah, you can find me there. Questions, stuff like that, feel free to reach out. I usually help, you know, when I have time. But, yeah.
And you're full of bad ideas.
That is true. I constantly feed you with terrible ideas that you think are awesome.
We didn't even talk about any of the bad ideas.
I know. You know about the one that I really want to do, Team America 2.0.
Yeah. We might. We'll have to do two. We'll have to do a part. We'll have to do another part, and maybe we'll throw some bad ideas out there for people to hate and think is stupid, but don't realize that they don't know that how awesome the idea is. That's how we'll frame this.
Sounds good.
Awesome. Well, we appreciate you being on tonight and, you know, yelling with us. I think, you know, comparable energy.
Yeah.
So that's good.
Yeah. Awesome. Good. Thanks for having me on, guys.
And yeah, have a good one.
Psst. It's that time again, boys. I need those goddamn reviews. You can say that Devin is forcing you to do them, or you can leave some genuine feedback, and I'll be sure to read them and get them back to the boys. In the meantime, you can join our Facebook group, which is Professional Awesome Technical Forum. You can follow us on Instagram at Professional Awesome Racing, and we have a Facebook regular page with the same name. But until then, we'll talk to you later, and we really appreciate you listening.